Hi, welcome to the show.
Much has been written about how to evaluate stocks in order to buy them, but less has been written about what you need to do before you decide to sell them. To every investing equation, there are two sides, the buying side and the selling side, or opening the transaction and closing the transaction. So today, I want to give you a short list of tips on how to make good selling decisions. I refer to an article recently titled, When Do I Sell Stocks? By James DeMasi on a website called GuruFocus.com, which, by the way, is probably my most favorite site, GuruFocus.com. We all know the best time to buy a stock is when its price is attractive relative to its future earnings and growth potential, a price that delivers true value with significant growth potential. But selling a stock isn't an easy decision because you fundamentally have to ask yourself, do I sell this now or do I stay invested for longer? You know, it's this proverbial $64,000 question. And I think many of you might actually have experienced this firsthand had you invested, for example, in companies like Google. You know, at its IPO, it was around $100 a share. So when it doubled, would you have sold? When it tripled, quadrupled, and so on? Every $100 threshold, you could have sold and done extremely well. But there's the dilemma. Do you hold and look for a 10-bagger in the case of Google, or do you sell and take a profit? Because really, how many companies do perform like that? Now, here's another common scenario. Say you buy a stock and it shoots up 60% in just 3 months, way sooner than you expected, and perhaps with a momentum that you feel might be unsustainable. What then? Do you take your gains now and perhaps buy the stock back again if it drops to where you think it's become a value stock again? Or do you wait until it reaches your target sell price and then offload? The fundamental question you've got to ask yourself is this. Does selling make sense given everything I know about this company? That is the single most essential question that you have to ask yourself before you push the sell button. Sometimes you might just find that you actually don't know enough about the company and need to do more research, and that's never a bad thing because it'll only make you better informed on the insides of a company that you're invested in, and you are a owner of that company. And if you were the 100% owner, you'd be paying attention. So you have to treat every investment as if you're 100% owner. Now, the article in GuruFocus.com gives us an example of the should I sell decisions that Mark Zuckerberg, you know, the founder of Facebook, had to make as he was growing his company. In 2004, Zuckerberg received a $10 million offer to sell that he apparently did not consider for even a minute. Then, just a year later, in 2005, MTV made a $75 million offer for Facebook, which he too rejected. And then another year later, he received not one but three offers from MTV, Yahoo, and AOL, all above $1 billion. And guess what? He said, no, I think my company's worth a lot more. I may never have an idea as good as this again, so I'm not interested in selling. Wow, what a way to think. What confidence in what you know and what you're doing and how it's valued than that statement. So in confidently refusing these offers, Zuckerberg was sticking to his circle of competence. That's a term that Buffett uses all the time. Because no one knew Facebook better than him, and that clarity of its business model and true worth gave him the confidence to reject a $1.5 billion offer. That's pretty incredible. Especially when you're in your mid-20s and someone dangles over $1 billion in front of you, saying no takes guts and reflects an unshakable faith in yourself and your company. And his refusal to sell has, of course, worked out really well for him. So if you do not fully understand the business that you're invested in, you'll depend on the market to give you a sense of its value. And a market of buyers will always want to undercut you on price. Remember, everyone's looking for a deal. Think about that. So, when should you sell? Well, if you listen to Warren Buffett, the best time to sell is never. As Buffett puts it, only buy something that you'd be perfectly happy to hold should the market shut down for 10 years. And Buffett has that confidence because he makes sure he fully understands the business and the long-term economics of the companies he invests in. Much like Buffett, when you're doing your research on shares, you might want to buy. Imagine you're buying a private company that will not go public for at least 5 years or more. And then ask yourself, what do I need to know before I lock myself into the stock for 5 years? You'd want to know who runs the business, what their past experience and successes are, what their weaknesses are, what the company's business model is, how well it's competitively positioned within its industry, its strengths, its weaknesses, its opportunities, its threats, its supply chain, the profile of its customers. You get the picture. It's not an easy task. But let's also be real. Not everyone has the background or the mental makeup of a Warren Buffett. Moreover, businesses often change over time, and long-term ownership may not always be practical, especially in industries such as technology, where obsolescence and growth go hand in hand at a very rapid pace. Another investing legend, Philip Fisher, outlined the following three conditions on which you would sell. And here's what my notes tell me. When you realize that your initial analysis was materially wrong, sell. When shares no longer qualify as a good investment because of a material deterioration in the company, such as manager complacency, exhausted growth opportunities, and product obsolescence, sell. When you clearly have a better opportunity for higher returns, but on this last point, you must be absolutely sure of your analysis to justify a switch because you have to factor in the possibility of being 20% or 30% off the mark. Plus, when you sell, you have to pay taxes too, so you have to climb over the bump created by the loss from taxes. So, be thorough in your analysis, and that will give you the confidence and the insights on when to hold and when to sell. And remember, it takes many, many years for those great investments to evolve. So when you do buy a company, make sure to stay invested for the long run. Stay tuned for the four financial habits of highly effective and wealthy CEOs with Editor-in-Chief of Inc. Magazine. I'd like to welcome Eric Schoenberg. He is the Editor-in-Chief of Inc. Magazine, a wonderful magazine, and Eric is with us right now. Welcome to the show, Eric.
Nice to be here. Thanks.
One of your articles that I enjoyed reading was The Four Financial Habits of Highly Effective and Wealthy CEOs. You know, Eric, with most entrepreneurs laser-focused on their business, so many forget to take care of their own personal finances. Tell us about that.
Well, you've got that absolutely right. The main thing about these four habits of highly effective and wealthy CEOs is that they avoid the biggest problem, is they don't diversify. They have all their risk and all their hopes in one basket, namely their company. And
right.
They figure that, well, sometime in the future I'll sell this for millions of dollars and I'll be set.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
mm-hmm.
Maybe, but maybe not. So the habits are ways of getting your risk out of your company and diversifying.
Very good. So what would be the kind of the first blush habit to look to do?
The first one is to fund a dedicated retirement account.
Mm-hmm.
You may think that this is obvious, especially if you're working for a company, but for a lot of entrepreneurs, it's not obvious. They really think that it'll all be taken care of at the company. So one of the best ones, if you are a solo worker or hire only contractors, is what's called a solo 401k.
Why is that a good one?
Well, it allows you to set aside as much as $50,000 a year of retirement income. And if your wife is working for you too, you can each do that. So that adds up to $100,000.
That could build up pretty quickly.
It can. It can. I mean, you have to have enough income to support that. But it not only can add up quickly, but it's tax deferred. So it comes off right off the top off your personal income. That's, as far as the IRS is concerned, in the year you earn it, it disappears.
Right.
You only have to pay taxes on the back end when you pull the money out.
Right. And then the money grows, of course, tax deferred, like an IRA or something like that.
Exactly.
Sure. So fund a dedicated retirement account for yourself once you can afford to do that. And remember, one other, I think, rule of thumb that people forget about is make sure you diversify within your pension plan. I want to discuss that in a little bit more detail later on. But let's go to number two. Number two is what?
Well, it's very similar to that idea that you just raised, which is when you fund that 401k, solo 401k, or whatever kind of retirement plan you have, profit sharing, whatever, don't overload it with your own company stock.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's an easy mistake to make because you think, well, I know this company, I have a lot of faith in it, and buying stock will show that. Well, nobody has perfect foresight into the future. You don't know that your company is going to be healthy, you know, without any interruption. So you want to spread your risk out.
Yeah.
Get some of your future out of your company and diversify it across a whole range of stocks or other investments, not just stocks.
Here's an interesting point as well. So let's say you do put some money aside in a retirement account and you don't put in your own personal, your own company stock rather, but you're in an industry and let's say you like other companies in your industry. Let's just say you're in the auto industry. It's not a great example, but you know, don't go out and buy other auto industry stocks because there's a tendency that when a cyclical industry goes out, you know, the tide goes out, all of the boats go out with it. So when you diversify, also diversify outside of your industry, not only outside of your company. What do you think of that?
I think that's a great idea. Doing otherwise is like suggesting you have a well-stocked wine cellar because you have 100 cases of wine, but they're all the same vintage.
Mm-hmm. Very good point. All right, number three, this is again the four habits, the four financial habits of highly effective and wealthy CEOs. Number three, Eric.
Is to sell some of the equity. Again, diversification is the key overriding factor here. Get the money out of your stock, out of your own stock or your own options. What you don't want to find yourself in is the situation in the future when you have to sell, when you're under pressure, mm-hmm. because you'll probably be selling at the low point in the cycle.
Do many entrepreneurs or these wealthy CEOs, do they do all this by themselves or do they put together a team to help them?
I think it's always better to have a team. You're running a business and that is a full-time job and then some. So you're not going to be current on investment and tax and retirement planning strategies. You ought to have a financial professional. You ought to have a financial planner. You probably also should have an estate planning attorney mm-hmm. to help you make sure that if you're not around, that your money is going to go where you want it to.
My guest is Eric Schoenberg. He is the editor-in-chief of Inc. magazine, and we're talking about the four financial habits of highly effective and wealthy CEOs. So you want to build a team. You want a tax advisor, maybe an estate planning attorney, an experienced investment advisor, someone who's working in your best interest, and someone also who knows how to work with a team of professionals to help you. So it's like any other area of your business. You know, stick to what you know, and what you don't know, hire a group of experts for you. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
What does an estate planning attorney bring to the mix under this?
Well, estate planning laws are a science unto themselves. And what they can help you do is make sure that all the complications of estate planning laws and estate taxes that vary the national level and the state level work in your favor. These are mistakes that this area is fraught with mistakes that if you make them, there is no going back. Your heirs will be saddled with your mistakes forever.
Good point.
And tax rates on estates are very high. They run 55%. So that is, you know, to get something wrong, to have too much money in your estate, to have too much money in your taxable estate is a problem you will pay for.
Also, a smooth transition between you and your heirs is also pretty valuable. And estate planning can take care of that so your money doesn't get caught up in probate, which can be a public affair. Probate has to be declared to the public, but you can set up trusts and others that don't. Eric, I want to change topics here real quickly. A survey that Inc. recently conducted, I think, went against the conventional wisdom because so much is written when a new company gets started about getting financing for that growing business, finding equity investors or angel investors. But your survey found something completely different. Tell us about that.
This survey was conducted with Inc. 500 CEOs. So these are the CEOs of the 500 fastest growing private companies over the past 3 years. So these are very successful people. And yet 77% of those founders told us they got their company started using their own personal savings. And nearly the same number of founders told us that they funded their growth during this growth spurt that got them into the Inc. 500 also through without going outside. They funded it with cash flow from their own operations.
You know, again, I don't know why, you know, maybe it's the media's fault or it just is something to write about. I'm not really sure, but you really get the sense that the first thing you need to do is put together a business plan and go to a bank. But that, in fact, is just not the way it's done. Why isn't it done that way?
Well, there are many reasons it's not done that way. I was about to respond to the question you didn't ask about why does the press give so much attention to venture capitalists? And the answer is, you know, they're public events, they're dramatic events, they're a way to keep score. You know, I raised $13 million in an A round of funding.
Right.
I think that's the fascination for it. But remember that when you raise money from an angel or a VC, you're basically selling your company before you've even gotten started. So you lose control. And then think about all the opportunity costs, all the time you spend on roadshows, trying to drum up money, it distracts you from the growth in your own company.
That's very true. Yeah, I mean, I know an investor who actually did get a parent company, a private equity firm, to help fund. But as he grew this division within the company, he's funding it with his own money, because in order to bring that private equity firm back in for further funding, he would have to dilute his own shares. And he was unwilling to do that. It's kind of a different take on the same subject, whether you're starting your own or whether you already have a private equity investor, but you really don't want to go back to the trough and ask for more.
Yes, that's really true. You think about it, if money were no object, you wouldn't bring in all these other people unless they really were partners and really were advisors. It can be a major distraction, you know, depending on how many investors you have. There are that many more voices who are giving you perhaps contradictory advice about what you ought to do next with your company. Raising capital from the outside is sometimes necessary, but it is almost always a mixed blessing.
So would you say that too many startup entrepreneurs look to outside capital first rather than attempting to build incrementally through their own internal sources?
I would say that's really true. It's tempting, but the discipline that's imposed by bootstrapping your own company is the sort of thing that will serve you well over the life of your company.
Very interesting. My guest, Eric Schoenberg, Editor-in-Chief of Inc. Magazine. Thanks so much for joining us, Eric.
My pleasure, Steve.
This is Steve Pomerantz, and you're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. What will surprise you most when you retire? The Wall Street Journal asked this question and got some interesting answers. They asked Morgan Fairchild, an Emmy-nominated actress, said free time isn't all that you expect, and although she's not yet retired, many folks find time on their hands is not all it's cracked up to be. Another answer from Ken Deichwald, a psychologist, gerontologist, and author of 16 books, said the loss of social connections was his greatest surprise. Those that are still working put down loss of income as the thing they will miss, but retirees surveyed said in no uncertain terms that more than anything, it was the social connections they miss the most. Mark Friedman is CEO and founder of Encore.org, a nonprofit organization. He said, retirement is a transition, not a destination. Those hitting traditional retirement age today should probably expect the unexpected. After all, they're pioneers on the frontier of mapping out a new road of life. There's 10,000 people a day that are flooding into their 60s. Bud Hiebeler was president of an aerospace division of Boeing. He said a lot can surprise you in 20 or 30 years of retirement. Often retired people are surprised by the cost of health care and how fast they escalate with age. But the biggest surprises are those that are completely unknown at the moment. These are things like a relative needing support, major home repairs, a market crash, death of a breadwinner, or a large uninsured loss. Many, many other unforeseen things can happen in 20 or 30 years of retirement. Another surprise occurs when local family members, like children and grandchildren, suddenly pull up stakes and move to pursue job opportunities, so it's up to the retiree then to have the money to travel to stay in touch. So the answer varies from person to person, but the takeaway is to prepare for a long life after retirement and get the most out of your time. Whether it's reconnecting socially, filling your time with interesting and worthwhile endeavors, or making sure you have enough put aside for the unexpected, retirement is definitely the new frontier, and we should all embrace it. Sharon Epperson and I talk college funding next.
I think that parents also have to be mindful that those are actually great lessons to teach your child, that it doesn't come easily, that you have to work hard for your education.
Stay tuned. Are there any topics we're missing? Guests we haven't thought of that you'd like on the show? Questions you want answered? Contact us anytime at stevepomerantz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. Simply go to stevepomerantz.com and click Contact to write us anytime, anywhere. Articles on the site you liked or didn't? Want to share your 2 cents? Comment on any of our guest interviews and tell us. You know, this show's purpose is to empower and protect you on all things financial. We'd love to hear your feedback so we can make sure we're getting you the information you need to live your one best financial life. Contact us at any time at stevepomerantz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. Many parents are struggling to figure out how they'll pay for rising college costs, and some are willing to dip into their retirement savings and delay retirement to do so, but many may not realize that in doing so, they may be jeopardizing their own financial security. Let's explore the subject with Sharon Epperson from CNBC. Hey, Sharon, welcome back.
Good to be on the program.
It seems that some parents are worrying more about the impact of long-term student debt on their own children than they are on their own retirement. Is this a reasonable strategy for those who are trying to apportion out their savings for the future?
Well, it certainly is reasonable for parents to be very concerned about their children having to take out student loans. And when you look at the average student loan balance, near $29,000, that's a lot of money that you don't want to have your child saddled with for many years to come. So it's understandable that parents want to do as much as they can to alleviate that burden. The problem is where they go to find the money to help their child pay for it. Mm-hmm. And tapping your 401k or your retirement savings is not the place to go.
The idea, I guess, the way I look at it and counsel clients is, you know, your children have a much longer lifespan and much more time to pay this off than you do. So it makes sense to allow them to shoulder, you know, a good deal of that debt. Do you think that fits in with what you're saying?
That absolutely fits in with what I'm saying. It makes complete sense. And we know that college costs have been rising and exponentially in some cases compared to when we were in school. But the reality is many parents worked or took out loans or went to school and then took off some time and then went back to school. They did many things to get their education. And I think that parents also have to be mindful that those are actually great lessons to teach your child, that it doesn't come easily, that you have to work hard for your education, and that in some cases you may have to take out loans, but you have to also be disciplined enough to pay those back. So I think that could be a very important financial lesson to teach your child and letting them know that everything will always be paid for just like it was until they were 10 years old. Going into their 30s is not necessarily the financial lesson that you want to leave with them.
Absolutely. You know, we look at it as a four-legged stool. One leg may be the loans that we're talking about. Another would be helping out the kids through parents working and their current income and putting some money aside for that. The third would be the children working for themselves, you know, so.
And the other one is we're all hoping for, right? Free money. Free money, please. And I think that's something that parents and their children need to start looking at very early and thinking about very early. For all of the money the parents spend on soccer, on violin lessons, ice skating, these things that we're hoping are going to make our children more well-rounded, some of them are really excelling at it. So there are opportunities perhaps for scholarships and to start looking early at what really are the criteria to get some of those scholarships is something that can be done very easily going to a website like FastWeb, which has thousands of different types of scholarships that are listed, looking at the organizations that you belong to locally and what scholarships that are given out by some of those organizations. Even some big box stores, you know, Lowe's may have a scholarship or there may be a scholarship with another organization that you're a part of, a trade organization or some such. So it's important to start looking at those things early and having your child kind of develop a resume. It sounds kind of crazy, but it's not. You know, early in high school, maybe even junior high school, to try to think about what some of their attributes are that will make them a great candidate for a scholarship.
Oh, that's really well said. My guest is Sharon Epperson from CNBC. We're talking about striking that balance to help your kids go through college and pay those ever higher college bills. Let's look at some more steps towards getting to this balance. Number one, the first dollars that you save should go into your 401k, and we're talking about the parents, of course, or workplace retirement plan. Tell us about that.
Well, I think it's important that you do put yourself first. We always say, and I'm sure you tell your clients as well, to pay yourself first, and it's equally important when you're trying to figure out how to prioritize your savings between retirement and college. You still need to do that because, as you mentioned at the top of this interview, you know, you do not have as long to actually recover from a financial setback as your child will have. So you want to make sure that you have substantial, at least ample, savings for your retirement. And the best way to do that, put it on autopilot, make sure you're contributing at least up until your company's matching contribution if they offer one for your 401k. And if you do not have a 401k at work, if you're not working or you're self-employed, You know, and if you qualify, a Roth IRA is a great place to go. And some of the opportunities that self-employed folks have out there to save for retirement are even better than if you're, you know, working and you get a 401k. So look into those options as well. But make sure you're putting your first dollars that you're saving into a retirement account for yourself.
You know, for a lot of people, it's really just hard to find the extra dollars to save. And this idea of paying yourself first is vitally important. Really, what's at work here is getting the habit or the discipline of putting money away on a regular basis, even if it starts at a small amount. It's really this idea of being able to accumulate wealth, and then eventually you can get it invested, and over time that wealth can work on its own to build more wealth for you. But it's getting started, it's finding those extra dollars in order to do that. It's a hard thing for many people to do, but it is vitally important. Also, this idea that if you're saving and yet you have a lot of money on credit card debt and you're paying high interest rates doesn't make sense either.
That doesn't make any sense. You really want to pay off those credit cards and pay off any high interest debt that you have, because you know you want your investments to be making as much money as they can. But the reality is the interest rate on your credit card on average is probably about 13%. It's unlikely that you're making that kind of return in the market. So yeah, you want to make sure that while you are putting some money away for your retirement, that you're also at the same time paying off that credit card debt. That might mean that you're not putting in the maximum amount. Again, I still think it's important to do it at least until the company's matching contribution, but you may not be able to put in the maximum amount that you're eligible for into the 401k or into an IRA, but at least put in something and then also at the same time start paying down that high interest debt.
So many people are so attuned and so good at finding bargains and, you know, not paying list price, finding the best deals, but then they have to turn around and buy those things on their credit card and pay 13%. So really, what's the point of going out there and spending all your efforts to get things cheaply if you're just going to actually just paying it back to the credit card company? It doesn't make sense. So really use your credit card as a tool, not as a way for you to finance your consumption. What about an emergency fund? People have got to have emergency funds.
Well, and then the question comes, how do I, you've just told me to pay off my credit card and to save for my retirement.
Right,
how am
right.
I supposed to come up with money for an emergency fund?
Right.
And there are ways that you can cut expenses. I know I remember interviewing a couple in Florida a few years ago, and they were aware that one of them was going to lose their job soon. And they were saying, but, you know, we'd still love to take you out to dinner and, you know, talk about whatever we were talking about at the time. And I thought, now, you know, you're about to be laid off. That's the last thing we need to do is go out to dinner. The last thing you need to do is spend money eating out. There are ways that you can cut back. That's an example where some people may say, well, we don't eat out, so where are we supposed to save? Maybe it's, you know, raising the deductible on your auto insurance or your car insurance so you have a little bit more income, cash coming in that you can put toward your emergency fund, building up your emergency fund so at least it's enough to cover the deductibles on these items. There are ways that you have to think about in terms of just the real basics. What do you really need to have money for this month? And what's kind of the extra? And let all those extras go by the wayside and put that money into savings to build up that emergency fund. That's very important.
I'm speaking with Sharon Epperson from CNBC. To hear this interview again and to join our conversation, you can do so at onthemoneyradio.org. You know, there are still a lot of people out there that smoke, and cigarettes are really expensive, $6 a pack. I mean, I think it's $10 a pack in New York or something like that. I mean, that adds up. That's a tremendous amount of money that adds up. So I realize how difficult it is to quit. I used to be a smoker many, many years ago. It's hard, but you know, you can get over it, and it can really put a lot of dollars in your pocket.
Mm-hmm. Whatever that big expense is. I mean, a lot of folks now, too, if you have tweens or teens like I do, they don't watch television that much. So why do I need a full-on cable internet plan if most of the watching is on a device, whether it's their iPad or my phone or something else? So there are ways to think about, you know, that's another more expensive mobile plan perhaps than you've had before, but in place of maybe a cable TV plan that you don't really need. There are just different ways to really think about how you are using what you're spending your money on. You know, do you really need to be spending the money that particular way? And your idea of going and finding bargains, I know a lot of people are great at that. And even if you're not someone who goes through and counts coupons and does things like that, sites like RetailMeNot, shopping for groceries online. So you look at the unit price and you're looking for what's cheapest based on the unit price, not even necessarily the sales that are there. Yeah, you pay for a delivery if you're in a big city and you have this opportunity to have groceries delivery. You might have a delivery fee, but the overall savings, if you're able to kind of look at all of the offerings you have in terms of groceries and pick the ones that really are kind of the cheapest that fit what you need for that week, I found that a great way to save on groceries, which are a necessity, but maybe doesn't need to be as expensive as what I've spent in the past.
Yeah. You know, it's not easy, but it's just a well-thought-through life. It's like pull your financial self together, start thinking broadly about these things instead of just operating on momentum or inertia and just doing things because it's the way you've always done them. And there's one quote that I like that you wrote, "Remember, you and your child can always borrow for college, but you can't borrow for retirement. So take care of yourself first." Sharon Epperson from CNBC, as always, very informative, and I thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Terry Storian Real Estate Roundup is next.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same. There's a green one and a pink one and a blue one.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Storey. Terry is a 24-year veteran with Coldwell Banker, located in sunny Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
I love when we do your real estate survival guide. It's my favorite part of the show. So you've got a couple of them for us today. Take us through the first one.
Steve, the first one is, what happens when you're trying to show a house and the tenant won't cooperating in letting you in the house?
Mm-hmm. Have you ever had that experience as an agent?
I'm living through it right now, Steve. It's very challenging. But really, the question that was proposed was, a seller is trying to sell his rental property, and the real estate agents are not having any luck with the tenant cooperating. The tenant is always paid on time and does take decent care of the property, but doesn't even seem to be available anytime there's a prospective buyer that wants to take a look at the house. What are your rights? What can you do? So that was the question that was presented to Gary Singer, who's a local real estate attorney. Here's the answer. The law and most written leases allow landlords access to rental properties for a couple of reasons. One, to make repairs, provided that there's an agreed upon service and that showing the property to lenders, contractors, and prospective tenants. The landlord must give reasonable notice to the tenant to access the property. Now, this is where the problem lies. What is considered reasonable amount of time? The tenants have no skin in the game. They're going to be moving out of the property. They have no reason to cooperate except just to be nice.
They may be resistant.
They are resistant. They don't know, you know, why do they have to do this?
Mm-hmm.
They're never going to keep the property. Now, and this isn't fair to say. There's no skin in the game, bottom line.
Yeah, I get it.
An owner is going to always bend over backwards to get a prospective tenant or buyer into a property. So it makes it very, very difficult. And there's a lot of games that, you know, are played with the tenants. You call them and they didn't get the message or they can't be available at that time. So really what happens, the landlord needs to have conversations in advance with the tenants about the situation, really when they go ahead and come to terms with a lease.
Maybe they should also offer the house or the place for sale to the tenant.
Yes, absolutely. That's an excellent idea. And some of them can afford to buy it and may even want to do that. So that would probably be the first thing I would do.
Right.
I would present it to them. Hey, I want to sell my house. Do you have any interest in buying it? Let them have first crack at it. Offer them a better price to do so. The next step in all of this is, you know, you're going to inconvenience the tenant. The tenant really doesn't want this. This isn't his job. But what you might consider doing as a landlord, throw in a little discount for the remaining portion of the terms of the lease, that, you know, whatever percentage you think is fair and reasonable for that tenant to cooperating and having it shown. I've seen that work out quite well. They might not be as reluctant to allow them to get in, but as a landlord, you have to put yourself in their shoes and see what is being asked of them. And that might help it a little bit, but legally, they're supposed to cooperate.
it's very gray as to what that cooperation is going to be.
Well, I think that the bottom line here is that the law is on your side. You own the property. If you give reasonable notice and the tenant is absolutely being obstinate, then you, once given reasonable notice, then I guess you have the right to go in and show you the property. It is your property.
You have to be very careful, though. You don't want to just open up the house. There can be accusations of missing and broken items, harassment.
Mm-hmm.
All kinds of things can be said, you know, against you. Really, the only time that landlord can access the property is really in a case of an extreme emergency.
Okay.
House is burning down, a real genuine emergency. That's mm-hmm. when the landlord has the rights to enter it. Otherwise, they're really at the mercy of the tenant.
All right. Well, we have a second real estate survival guide item today. And by the way, you're listening to Terry's Story. Terry is with Coldwell Banker, located in Boca Raton, Florida. And this is our segment every single week called Real Estate Roundup. Ignoring insurance risks can be costly. Tell me about that.
When you buy a home, part of the formula for the total cost is, what is it going to cost you for insurance? And there's some factors that you need to take into consideration. Insurance seems to be the last piece of the puzzle that people shop. They shop interest rates, they shop all these other things, and they listen to what the lender tells them what an approximate insurance cost will be, but that never seems to be quite accurate. So if you're a buyer and you find a property that you like, you might want to make that phone call to an insurance agent.
Mm-hmm.
So what are these items that have an impact? Start with location. Where's your location in comparison to the fire station?
Mm-hmm.
Are you near a fire hydrant? All of these things can help reduce your cost. Another big one, flood zone. This is probably the biggest of them all. Are you east of I-95? Where are you located in the flood plain? It's an excellent idea for everyone to carry flood insurance, but there's certainly higher risk flood plains that flood insurance require additional policies, and you can find out that those figures can be quite high.
Yeah, and many of our listeners are not in the state of Florida, don't probably even know what I-95 is. The bottom line is, if you're in a flood zone, you'll know it. You know it, and that's going to affect your insurance rates.
Right. Anything near water, you're in a flood.
Okay. What about the age of the home?
Age of the home, very important. Let's start with the roof. Roof is very important. Once a roof is 20 years, it's considered a high risk.
Uh-huh.
And the roof needs to have at least 3 years of life left to it for an insurance company to even write insurance for it.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to factor in, you know, what is it going to cost to replace the roof if you don't have that remaining life? They also have to take into consideration, what is the roof material made up of? So all of these factors play into what that cost of insurance is going to be.
Yeah, but the bottom line is, when you're buying a house, you're taking a look at what your mortgage, your principal and interest is going to cost you. You're taking a look at what taxes are going to cost you, and that's kind of can be tricky as well. And really, the third component is insurance, and you really don't want to be shocked. So do your homework early, so when you're figuring out all the math and all the numbers to make sure that this place is affordable and within your budget, make sure you take a look at what the insurance premium will cost on this particular property.
That's right. I mean, that's really the bottom line. Be aware. You know, does the house have a swimming pool? If it has a swimming pool, it's going to be an additional premium.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so call around and get some quotes.
That's right.
All right. Terry Story with Coldwell Banker, located in Boca Raton. This is our Real Estate Roundup segment. And Terry can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
The power of saying, I don't know. Next.
If you're not confused about the global economy today, you don't understand it.
StevePomerantz.com now features each week's show in shareable individual segments. Busy at work and want to come back to the show later? No problem. Every segment has a full summary of what was discussed, along with a transcription of the interview. You can read or listen to one of my commentaries. Hey, is there something I mentioned on air you want to find on our site? Well, you can search for it. So check it out and let us know what you think. We'd love to hear your thoughts on what you liked or what you didn't. You can request topics you want us to talk about and ask us questions. We'll get back to you, promise. And you can like us on Facebook, where you'll find out about upcoming events and subscribe to our podcast. It's all there at StevePomerantz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. This is Steve Pomerantz, and you're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. Vitaly Katsanelson is a chief investment officer at Investment Management Associates in Denver, which is a value-oriented investment firm, specializing, as I said, in value investments, and he writes extensively for Institutional Investor magazine and other important publications. He's been with me on the show a number of times, and he's a great source and a great investor himself. Welcome back to the show, Vitaly.
It's my pleasure, Steve.
So I know you're writing all the time, and one of your more recent writings was about be careful trusting financial pros who are reluctant to say, I don't know. And these are investments learned from the poker table. So I don't know, these three words don't inspire a lot of confidence and may not get you on CNBC. So give us an idea of the framework in which you're thinking about, you know, what you do know, what you don't know, and all of that.
So I wrote this article a while back, and in that article, I think on one page I said, you know, I talk about the risk of inflation, and on the second page I talk about risk of deflation. And I got a number of emails telling, you know, one guy was saying, oh, you're crazy, there's no way we're going to have inflation. And I got other emails saying, oh, you're crazy, there's no way we're going to have deflation. And one thing I realized, that you have this kind of inflationary and deflationary camps, people who are very certain that you're going to have inflation or deflation. And the problem is, if you are certain about inflation, you're going to buy gold.
Yeah.
And if you're going to have inflation, you're going to make a lot of money. But God forbid, if you have deflation, you're going to get annihilated. And same thing about deflation. If you think, you know, we're going to have deflation, you're going to buy 30-year treasuries. And because of deflation, you make a lot of money. But the cost of being wrong is very high, because if you have inflation, you lose a lot of money.
Yeah, so let's just stop for a minute there. I want my audience to understand. So gold will go up if we have inflation, because the currency itself is kind of being devalued, and therefore the price of gold in terms of dollars goes up. If deflation is the case, then loaning a long-term bond, which gives you a fixed income stream, that does better because that fixed income stream becomes more valuable. Is that right?
You're absolutely right. The point I wanted to make is that we live in a very difficult environment today, when we never had quantitative easing done globally on such a scale.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, there is no playbook. There's, you know, you can go to history books and, you know, where, you know, and look and say, if when this happened in the past, this what happens next. Because we never had this happen before. Therefore, my concern is people who are very convinced in one outcome or another may suffer from what's called in poker the second best hand.
Second best hand. Like in poker, yes. You don't want the second best hand, right?
Yes, because what happens is, like, you have a very, very good hand, and you think you're going to win, so you're going to bet a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And God forbid somebody else's hand just slightly better.
Mm-hmm.
You lose. And in today's environment, you basically want to have enough humility to say, I don't know. And I think those three words are very important, because if you say them, we try to create a portfolio for I don't know world, where I have no idea if we can have inflation or deflation. And I try to put a portfolio of stocks like cockroaches that would do fine in either environment.
Yeah.
And I think it's very important to say I don't know, and then try to have a portfolio that either outcome would be fine. But let me just clarify one thing.
Sure.
It may not do as well. If you just position the portfolio for inflation and you just load it up on gold, that portfolio probably would, you know, that I will assemble probably would not do as well. And I'm, you know, if we just have inflation. But the cost of being wrong is very, very important. And I think this is what, you know, we are very aware of when we put the portfolio together.
Well, the first thing that comes to my mind when you speak about the I don't know portfolio is the portfolio that hedges in a sense, or is diversified enough that it may have some gold or something that does well in inflationary environments, maybe treasury and inflation protected bonds, right? TIPS, that where the interest rate goes up if interest rates rise, and interest rates generally rise in an inflationary environment. But you also may have some long-term bonds in the portfolio, and so on and so forth. So is that how you as an investment manager think about the I don't know portfolio? Is it through diversification?
Actually, not as much through diversification, but through stocks that would do fine in either environment.
Give me an example.
Okay, so a company that has a pricing power, let's say a pharmaceutical company.
Okay.
If you have inflation, they'll be able to raise prices.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have deflation, the pricing will not decline.
Okay.
And that would be like that would be a great example. And at the same time, they would not be levered, and therefore, if you have deflation, usually levered companies struggle because
levered levered means
have a lot of debt.
Debt, yes. Okay.
Yes. So, and at the same time, you basically have a company that would do fine in any environment.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily. So it's so we would still have a diversified portfolio. But it's not necessarily, we're trying to get to a goal, not through as much through diversification of owning like gold and 30-year treasury bonds, but more through securities that we define in either environment.
Well, you also run the risk when you have a beautiful portfolio like that of just totally being out of favor for a year or 2 years, where really the go-go stocks or the Netflixes and the Teslas and so on of the world are the only stocks that seem to be doing anything. And, as an investment manager, you're sitting there and you're looking at the balance sheets and you're looking at the growth of the book value in these companies. But the stock prices, are frustrating as all get out. As a portfolio manager, how do you cope with that?
Well, I think it's very important to differentiate how your stocks are priced versus what they're worth. In other words, when you look at stocks, you don't look at them as just pieces of paper or stocks. You look at them as businesses. And so when I look at my portfolio and we look at individual stocks, I actually have a fairly good idea of what each company in my portfolio is worth. And therefore, the difference between what it's worth and the price a lot of times creates an opportunity. If I buy a company and its price declines after I buy it, actually, it may be a good thing. And, let me give you one example, Apple.
Okay.
When Apple is buying back an enormous amount of stocks today, so when the stock price declines 20%, for instance, it means Apple can buy more, if the value of the company hasn't changed. Apple can buy more, 20% more shares. So in the long run, it actually would benefit, if you're a long-term share investor, it would benefit you if after you buy the stock, its price declines. Actually, it may benefit you actually in the long run.
Well, I think Apple's a good example because Apple was the hottest stock, really, I think, in the world for a while. And everybody was talking about that it was going to reach $100 trillion valuation. It never quite got there, but now it's kind of out of favor because they're kind of in between product cycles and they're still making good money, but kind of people don't really want to own it anymore. The people that have it are kind of like wondering, should I get rid of it? Of course, you're going to have the true diehards who are going to remain faithful and believe in it. But if you bought Apple today, like Berkshire Hathaway was reported to buy $1 billion worth of Apple. Now, we know that it wasn't Warren Buffett. He said it himself. It was one of his guys that did it. But, they're going to have to sit on that for a really pretty long time, I think, before it gets to a point where they go, I've received all the value I'm going to get from my initial investment. But that could take 5 years. Now, you're a portfolio manager, and you've got clients that you've got to cater to all the time and meet with and so on. What do you say to them?
Actually, Steve, I wrote this article. And it's available on our website. It's called Manifesto, the Values of Value Investing. And in that article, basically, it's an 8-page article. I explained that one of the most important things you and I can do with our clients is to bridge the gap that is created from asymmetry of research. You and I do a huge amount of work when we put investments in our clients' portfolios. But our clients don't, because that's why they hire us.
Mm-hmm.
So it's my job to communicate as clearly, as transparently as I possibly can to my clients why we own what we own and what we do.
Yeah.
And if I reach this gap and I kind of just get rid of this symmetry of information, then my clients, when things go bad, my clients will be very comfortable, because they know what's going on in their portfolio and then they understand the logic behind it.
Yeah.
So my clients, when the Apple stock declines, they actually applaud in it because, hopefully I communicated my thoughts about it. And they say, well, let's buy more instead of panicking about it.
Right. Well, there is this idea that investing in individual stocks, while I think it's kind of becoming more and more out of favor because index funds seem to be taking over the world, but this idea, at least with individual stocks, is that you have a sense for what you own, whether it's a Johnson & Johnson, a Procter & Gamble, a Coca-Cola, a Disney. You have a sense that there is a real company underlying and underneath. When you invest in an index fund, it's just a number that's bouncing up every day and down every day, and you don't really have a sense that you've got like 500 to like terrific companies in there. So I would say that, for the index fund investors, go on to some website like Yahoo open up that can or, you know, zip open the bag and look what's inside it, because that will help you maintain your courage in those periods of time when you see this S&P 500 go down. I think you're saying the same thing, right?
Yeah, the problem is, like, you know, the index fund is like, it's almost like a hot dog. You don't really know what goes inside of it.
Yeah. Well, that could be a good thing. I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's true. You're absolutely right. And I think this is why when clients open their statement and they see stocks in their portfolio, they can relate to them. You know, they can relate to Apple, yeah. They can, you know, to Qualcomm or Johnson & Johnson, whatever. And I think there was something to that as well. I agree with you.
My guest is Vitaly Katsanelson. He is Chief Investment Officer of Investment Management Associates located in Denver, and it's what is referred to as a value shop. He's looking at companies and their intrinsic value, trying to forecast what would be a fair value and what would be undervalued, and then make appropriate decisions. He's looking at balance sheets. He's just looking at the companies themselves. You know, I knew that you were getting a little bit frustrated because you're quoting Gandhi and Einstein. and as you said, that when you have to get to the point where you're quoting those two guys, you know, things are getting a little desperate. So allow me to read what you wrote here. So you're talking about investing in the current environment requires a lot of humility. And Gandhi said, it is unwise to be too sure of one's own wisdom. And it is healthy to be reminded that the strongest might weaken and the wisest might err. Einstein took the idea a step further, saying, quote, a true genius admits that he or she knows nothing. Smarter and humbler people than me were willing to say, I don't know, and it's okay for us mortals to say it too. I mean, if Einstein is saying that he doesn't know anything, and he's basically, I think, been the person I can point to that's changed the world the most, and Gandhi with his wisdom, I think we should all take a little bit from that. And I guess when you're investing, you sure as heck don't know what's going to happen in the future. And even sometimes, you know, getting back to your poker analogy, Vitaly, Sometimes the best player can't even get a break. You know, the really good players will look at the probabilities of their hand and the success of their hand, and they'll bet on strong probabilities. When they have a strongest probability of success, they'll bet large. I think that's what Buffett does, if you would agree. You know, he sits around, he waits, he watches a lot of hands go by, but when he sees the one that is so-called the fat pitch, as he puts it, he swings hard. But even someone at the table by random chance can still have a better hand. So final words for you about, I guess, humility. Take us there.
I'm going to quote Charlie Munger, Warren Buffett's partner at Berkshire Hathaway. He said at the annual meeting, at the Berkshire Hathaway annual meeting, if you're not confused about the global economy today, you don't understand it. And I think I can't say it better than that.
Yeah, it is impossible. Yeah.
And this is a brilliant person who basically says, I don't know.
Yeah. You know, the other manifestation that I've realized in the last year is that there's always something to worry about. And somehow these ideas bubble up in the media and they catch our attention through the headlines. You know, whether it's the European Union was an issue or the fiscal cliff. And those issues go away, they disappear, but then they're replaced by new issues. We always have this litany of issues and worries that bubble up. And in a way, it feels so manufactured to me. Do you have any ideas on that?
Well, I think what happens a lot of times, the news media tries to explain a movement in the stock market by some kind of micro event. So the market is going down, and now suddenly they're saying the market is worried about this, this, and this.
Yeah.
Market is going up, and they're just, you know, they're just changing their focus from negatives to positives.
Mm-hmm.
So in reality, stocks go up and down for reasons that I have, you know, in the short run, are random.
Yeah.
But if I owned the CNBC or CNN, I would be doing the same thing. Because If you watch CNN and it says markets went up because they did, or when you're on CNBC, you're probably not going to watch this channel much longer.
Yeah.
So I think media has to do this. But you as an investor need to be aware that, you know, this is just noise.
Yeah, fundamentally, you know, the commercial media is out there, as I always say, to sell soap. I mean, nobody gets to be at the desk on CNBC and get whatever salaries they're paid and have that major production unless they're bringing in advertising revenues, period. So they have to make sure that they keep your eyeballs glued to the set. My guest is Vitaly Katsanelson, Chief Investment Officer of Investment Management Associates in Denver, Colorado. Vitaly, thanks for taking the time to join us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks, Steve.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for our Ask Steve segment. This is where you submit your questions to us. Here's a question from Joan in Tampa, Florida. Steve, I am currently 63 years old, and I'm ready to retire and enjoy my grandchildren. I am aware that if I retire before my full retirement age, then I will not receive the full portion of my Social Security retirement benefits, and they'll be reduced by a certain amount. However, my husband, who's 65, is not ready to retire and is looking to continue working until age 70. Is there a way for my husband and I to maximize our monthly income in spite of my early retirement? Well, Joan, that's an excellent question. And by the way, it's one of the reasons that we like to get questions via email or via the toll-free line, because it gives us a chance to research it and to come up with a very good answer. And as I said, that is an excellent question. Several factors come into play when making a retirement decision. And there's good news for you here. We have found a way for you to take advantage of your own Social Security benefits and your spousal benefit that you qualify. Now listen closely, because there are some numbers involved here. For your situation, let's assume your full Social Security benefit when you retired at age 66 is $1,200 a month. The partial benefits at age 63 are $900. Your husband's full Social Security benefits are $2,400. I'm sorry for all the numbers, but bear with me. Okay, this is how it works. If you wait to retire at age 66, you're going to receive the $1,200, right? But since you want to retire before 66, you're going to get that reduced benefit of $900. Now, if your husband decides to retire in 5 years, he's going to get the $2,400, and then you're going to get your spousal benefit, which will be $1,200. And here's where it works out really well. You can take your own benefits now of $900, and when your husband retires, you can switch then to your spousal benefits and get half of what he gets, which is that $1,200. Even if you only get $900, you start getting some retirement income now, and then in 5 years, when your husband retires, you switch and you get more. You get $1,200. And here's the best part. Your husband might be happy to hear this one too, because if you're retired, he can choose to receive his spousal benefit of $600. Therefore, you get $900, he gets $600, now you get $1,500. And then once he retires 5 years from now, he'll get $2,400. You'll get half of his, which is $1,200. Now you're at a full $3,600. So now you can get $1,500, and then later on, when your husband actually retires, you can get $3,600. That's a win-win situation. So Joan, utilizing this strategy will allow you to receive a monthly income while staying at home. Hey, if you have a question for us, call us at our toll-free line, which is 1-866-MONEY-01. You know, I just want to remind you that any interviewee's appearance on The Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by The Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which The Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing and decisions concerning money and personal finance are important decisions. Listeners are advised to research and discuss financial decisions with a tax, legal, or financial advisor. On the Money Radio makes no claims, warranties, guarantees of any information discussed on this program. The advisor's inclusion as one of Worth's top 100 wealth advisors may not reflect any one client's experience. Inclusion on this list may not be indicative of the investment advisor's future performance. More information can be obtained online at the program's official radio website at onthemoneyradio.org or by calling the toll-free consumer line at 1-866-MONEY-01.